Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Open the pod bay doors now.
I'm sorry, Dan. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the most you ever lost in the contest?
Go ahead. Make my day.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to Black Hole Cinema. I'm Tony Black, back again for the second week running to host, and joining me today is, in his return appearance after our summer break, Mr. Leslie Byron Pitt.
Hello, how you doing? You right?
Pretty good, mate, pretty good, yeah. It's good to have you back. And joining us tonight is a brand new Black Hole Cinema contributor and first ever podcaster, so this is quite a momentous moment for us and for him. It's Kane Richards. Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
All good, mate. All good. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. We today are going to pick through the standard movie news. We're back to the actual like schedule now. So last week, even though it was our special summer episode, that was just a one-off schedule. We're back to how we do things normally now. So we'll start off with a bit of news. We'll go into one of our first two films then, which today are Legend and Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials. Although I think there's a suspicious lack of mazes in the second one. So it should just be called Runner, because there's just a lot of running. And then we'll pick over the UK and the US box office, because normally we do the UK box office, but I'm thinking that's a bit like, that's not really seeing the whole picture. So I thought, let's do both. And it turns out they're very different. And then we'll do another of our two films, and then we'll finish with a little chat about a certain actor who is very prominent this week, but we'll get to that later. So let's kick off with a bit of movie news. Don't know why I did that voice. That was like an introductory podcaster voice. It's not working. I'm trying too hard. Kane, do you want to kick us off? What's your movie news of the week?
My news is the potential King Kong versus Godzilla film. Basically, Legendary Pictures, they had the rights for a King Kong film, and they've moved the rights from Universal to Warner Brothers in order to make a shared universe between King Kong and Godzilla. So hopefully we could see a King Kong versus Godzilla film in the future.
Is that live action or anime?
Yeah, live action.
Yeah.
It'll be the same Godzilla from the 2014 film.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Versus a brand new King Kong.
Because Gareth Edwards is doing the sequel, isn't he,
to
Godzilla. So is the theory that he'll come back and...
It's not official yet. It's just kind of heavily rumoured. Basically, there'll be in 2017, there'll be a King Kong film, and then there'll be, the year after, there'll be Godzilla 2, and then after that, there's plans to do King Kong versus Godzilla.
Right, so we got another so-called shared universe, so to speak. Yeah.
You sound so happy, Les.
My biggest bugbear at this moment in time is just brand awareness and the idea about it. I don't really particularly mind if there was going to be a King Kong, a return of King Kong or Skull Island or anything else like that. I liked what Peter Jackson did before in 2005. And you know, obviously as a fan of film, I enjoyed, it's been a long time ago, but I enjoyed obviously the 1933 version. There's been so many King Kongs, there's been so many Godzillas. But what I'm finding really frustrating and what's really annoying is studios finding things that people kind of remember and know and going, yeah, well, we'll just mash it together and see what happens. I know it's more of a rumor more than anything else, and it could be good. I mean, it could be, but I think we're really screaming out for something. Well, I'm really screaming out for something original. I don't know how anyone else feels. I feel that most people are actually quite happy with brands and, you know, franchises and the like. Otherwise, they wouldn't be making money. Whereas everything I kind of want to watch or everything I kind of like doesn't make money. So I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens, and it'll be interesting to see if it does come into fruition and someone like Weta take over the whole of the effects and everything. But
yeah,
I don't know. I'm not holding my breath too much for this.
Well, personally, I'd like to see it happen because I think cinematically it could be amazing. But I do know where you're coming from. I mean, I would like to see a lot more original things because Hollywood now, it just seems like they're going back to past franchises, doesn't it?
I don't know. I like the idea of the scale.
Yeah.
If you can get Samus Garvey in or someone like that to shoot it, it'd be quite cool and quite interesting. But in all honesty, I'm just thinking what will probably happen is just you'll have all these humans running around not saying very much interesting thing, and it'll be about 3 hours long. But because of all the CGI, you're only going to get half an hour of each monster.
Yeah,
it's going to be a little. You know, that's my big issue. But
I'm cautiously optimistic, I'd say. I think, you know, the Toho have a history with Godzilla of having him fight all kinds of different monsters and things like that. So if they could replicate it, you know, in Hollywood along similar lines and maybe completely know how silly it is and not take it too seriously, because Godzilla took itself a bit too seriously sometimes, you know, the new one. I think if it does that, I think it could be a lot of fun, really, if you put these two iconic monsters together. So,
well, yeah. I think it'll just be a cinematic spectacle, really. That's all.
Yeah, we'll see what happens, I guess, with that. That's interesting. Les, what about you? What's your news this week?
I decided to pick a trailer. I'm not sure if anyone's seen it. I think it's just... It has really cut over the weekend. And it's the trailer Hardcore, starring Sholto Copley. I'm not sure if any of you guys remember or if you guys are on social media or whatnot. I think, Kane, you're on Twitter.
Yeah.
And and Tony, obviously, I've got you on FaceSpace and Twitter as well. But about a year ago, maybe a little bit longer, there was a music video that came out, and it was all shot in the first person, if you remember it. And it just had usually it was kind of, if you found the link, it was of this girl scantily clad and you just saw a bikini, but she's not really in it that long. But it was just a massive fight that kind of went all across the thing, but it was all from via perspective of the first person, so you couldn't see the person that was the so-called protagonist, but he would just fight and do the music video, and there was like a matter transporter that he was fighting for. It was very strange. And then obviously something like that happens, everyone, it goes viral, and then someone goes, you should make a movie out of something like this. So I had a quick look to see what was going on, and Hardcore is the name of the movie. I think it got a trailer TIFF, which is going on currently now. So it's on YouTube. Basically, it's weird. It's very strange. It's a little like the film Maniac, the remake Maniac with Elijah Wood, where you don't actually see the hero's face throughout, so it's going to be all throughout like that, and it goes all over the place, lots of jumping off stuff so you can see the depth and going up and down and everything else like that, and Sholto Copley just turns up for no apparent reason. It seems to be very sort of no rhyme or reason to it, other than it's going to be crank but shot like if you're playing Doom.
That actually sounds quite good.
It's bizarre. They are trying to sell it as if this film has never been made before, even though I know I've just mentioned Maniac. You can kind of take the first 8 minutes of Strange Days, Catherine Bigelow's Strange Days, yeah. And also, I think it's Who Dares Wins, an old 70s film.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit hawkish. But once again, you know, there's so many films that have done the whole down the barrel of a gun sort of thing. I think they're just trying to extend it and make it more extreme for the millennial crowd. It looks to be quite interesting. I do urge you to kind of check it out just for the fact that it's something that hasn't been done in this way before as an action movie. All the fight sequences in it seem to be real people, so it seems like it was a lot of timing. It had to be taken and nothing cuts away. Everyone kind of drops down and everything, so there is that sort of thing to it. And I think it will be worth it to see if you can watch it on the biggest screen possible and, you know, get vertigo from the amount of sheer drops that happen from it. But that was my, you know, my little bit of so-called news. I've kind of not really been following the news at the moment. There's a lot of just comic booky stuff and remakey stuff, and yeah, you know, just kind of waiting for the right thing to grab me. And that was just an interesting tidbit.
No, that is interesting. You do have to dig a little bit, I think, these days to find an interesting piece of news. You know, Kane, you've achieved it this week. Les, you've found one. But a lot of it is, yeah, it is, which, you know, tiny frame of Wonder Woman before it's been filmed can we show you today? It's, you know, it's that kind of thing. It does get a bit wearing. So I'm going to go completely the other way from, you know, popular culture and, you know, something massively in the news and talk about James Bond. My bit of news is one that everyone will know about, to be fair, that Sam Smith is recording the new James Bond theme for Spectre, which is out in about 6 weeks. And the song we're getting on the 25th of September, I believe, and it's called The Writing's on the Wall. I think that's possibly an allusion to the trailer where the James Bond's name is written in blood on a wall of fallen heroes. So I assume there's a link in terms of the film. Mm. I confess I had to actually go on Twitter and ask who Sam Smith was and if I should like him. I'm that out of touch with popular music.
I did see that and I laughed a lot because even though I know who he is, I think I've heard one song once.
Yeah.
And I'm exactly the same.
I'm not a fan at all, but I think he's quite big in today's pop charts. I think he's a Grammy winner even.
Is he? Oh, right.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, he's definitely a well-known name. And as I said to my girlfriend, I said, you know, he will, like Adele was, you know, Skyfall went to number one in the charts. This will, without question, go to number one. You know, it will make a fortune. And
she won an Oscar for that, didn't she, as well?
She did. And I mean, I thought Skyfall was a really good song anyway. It was a really good James Bond theme. But I liked Adele beforehand. You know, she has her detractors, but I've always quite liked Adele. I think she's really good. But I'm going into this completely clueless. And based on the Twitter question, I had about 10 responses, half of which were, he's brilliant! And half of which were, fucking dickhead. Basically, it was just like, I don't know what to believe.
Oh, that's the best thing about social networks now. You know, you can't have middlemen at all. You have to have one extreme or the other.
So who knows? Who knows what to believe? Since we're talking this, I've got to ask you the question. Favourite James Bond theme since we're here? Kane, have you got one?
What was the Casino Royale one?
You Know My Name.
Yeah, that was it, definitely.
Chris Cornell, that's a really good one. I was speaking about that to my boss, actually, only the other day. We were talking about Bond themes. That's a good one, yeah. Proper rock, raw kind of one. Les?
I would go with, and I don't think it's usually a favourite, but I really like Nobody Does It Better, but only when it's sung by Radiohead. they did a live version of it and it was fantastic.
I haven't heard that. I've got to seek that out now.
Yeah, I really enjoy that. If not, I would probably go with Tina Turner's Goldeneye.
That's a great one. That is a great one.
In fact, can I change mine? Sorry.
You can, absolutely can.
Diamonds Are Forever.
That's a good one. Can't beat a bit of Bassy, can you?
No.
That's really good. I mean, most of them are really good. My favourite is A View to a Kill. Because, I mean, that gets really slagged off by a lot of people. But for me, it's just pure 80s brilliance by Duran Duran. And I think my second one would be Live and Let Die. by McCartney and Wings, which is just awesome still.
That is a good one, and I should have chose that, but I'm going to stick with what I have.
Well, so. Live and Let Die, Live and Let Die is usually the most popular one, I think. Most people tend to say that one. But no, good choices, gents. I definitely approve. Right, okay, well, that's the news. That's the news this week. That's all that's been happening at all in our world, anyway. We're going to move straight on to our first film to be discussing this week, to be dissecting. And we're going to talk the new film by Brian Helgeland, Legend, which is about the Cray brothers in 1960s London, starring, of course, Tom Hardy. Here's a clip.
Hello. Did I miss anything important?
No, just me.
That is important.
Is it?
Very important. Thank you. So I had your brother who was telling me that you were going to college to study to be a secretary. Is that right?
Yeah, anything to get out of the East End.
What's so bad with the East End?
Just got bigger dreams than pushing a pram or having him with the butcher. Just don't quite know what they are yet.
Well, the East End's not that bad. The centre of the earth could be anywhere you like.
Even here?
Yeah, you've been here.
In Bethnal Green?
Yeah, Bethnal Green.
Do you like being a gangster?
I'm not a gangster. I'm a club owner. I like the money and I like the respect of being a club owner. I'm not a gangster.
So, yeah, I actually haven't seen Legend. I didn't get a chance this weekend. I hope to rectify that soon. So you guys both have. Kane, first, what did you make of this one?
I really liked it. I thought Tom Hardy's performance was just amazing. He used two spectacular performances as both Cray twins. But I think, although like he did power the film, I think it was let down a little bit by a weak story because it's... It's basically the legacy of the Crays, but through the viewpoint of Reggie's wife, not just kind of just showing their rise and fall, which I think it should have just done. I really did enjoy it, but I think it didn't reach its full potential.
So it's told through the perspective of Emily Browning's character, is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. So is she pretty much in every scene? Is that how it works?
No. She kind of like narrates.
Oh, I see.
So they'll show her, like, she starts off happy and then she can't get used to, you know, living with a gangster, basically. And it kind of just goes on from there. And then she'll narrate, like, key moments of their criminal rise. But I think they kind of, those scenes, they were too quick. I think they should have focused on them a bit more instead of kind of focusing on her and Reggie's relationship.
It's been getting mixed reviews in general, hasn't it? How about you, Les? What did you think?
I really like the performances from Hardy. I think it really does drive the film a lot. Yeah. You know, I think it's really important. If you get on board with him, then it's not too much of an issue. I had a massive issue with most of the rest of the film. I thought it was really Goodfellas light. You can even see that Helgeland is trying to kind of mimic certain aspects of Goodfellas there, obviously through the narration, which I found really shoddy and tells too much of the story as opposed to letting the camera do the work. Yeah. I didn't appreciate him trying to do a sort of Goodfellas first date thing as well with the long tracking shot camera type stuff. It just seemed to be kind of mimicry as opposed to trying to find its own kind of motifs and own style, so to speak. It was very much an American trying to have a look at what makes the British British. There's some awkward rhythms to the story that I found with it all the time. I just felt it went on for so long. It just, you know, as Kane was saying, you know, it would have been better as a rise and fall, but even scenes themselves are supposed to rise and dip and raise intention, and I just didn't find that to be true of the film at all. I just found myself waiting to see when was the next funny thing Ronnie might say.
No.
I think the dynamics between the character and between both the brothers, their mum, which is, you know, so usually, you know, in the 1990 film The Craze, no, that's kind of like the big thing that, you know, they go home to mum. Yes. If you read up the history of The Craze, that they you know, they left National Service to get back and they were back home in time for tea. That was, you know, it was a whole big British thing, and the mum sort of kind of pops up halfway through and she's hardly in the film, and I just think the dynamics of some of the characters were just badly put together, and I think Browning's kind of left high and dry with the material. I think she really needed a little bit more direction to see where things go.
She's not the best actress anyway, is she? No. Really, I mean, she's, when I saw her I was a bit surprised. I thought they might have got someone a little bit stronger to play such a linchpin character, really.
I don't think it's her fault, though. Maybe it's because I'm being soft. I found her in films that I don't particularly like. Sucker Punch, Sleeping Beauty, films like that. But, I'm always happy for her to go and do these films, because at least she's trying to do something interesting. But I just find that there's something lacking about performance, but I don't think it's of her. I think she has a very sort of, Cockney accent's a bit like this, isn't it? It's just a bit kind of, you know, it's someone who's not from England doing the accent.
Mm.
So you can kind of tell, and then obviously she's feeding through the narration, and it just doesn't sound right. It doesn't sound right at all. But then also it's narration, and when narration doesn't sound right, it's the most annoying thing in the world. It's one of these films where at one point it's mentioned that Ronnie doesn't trust the character, Davis Fewlis's character, Leslie Payne.
Yeah.
And instead of us getting a proper shot of him, us seeing him not trust him, you've just got Emily Browning going, well, Ronnie didn't really like him. He doesn't really trust Leslie Payne. He didn't like him. And I was like, well, I'm watching the film. Why didn't the film tell me this? So I was kind of frustrated with how it kind of flitters in and out all the time and just doesn't, you know, push what is so interesting, these characters. I didn't think the two really had any, both Browning and Hardy didn't really have any chemistry together, and I think one of the reasons why it was far too interested in other things, it kept jumping from bit to bit. There was a lot going on it was just over egged. There was a lot going on in it.
No.
And I don't think it finishes it all correctly as well. You know, you've seen someone like Christopher Eccleston turn up and he's hardly in it. Paul Bettany turns up.
He should have definitely been in it more, I think. Obviously, cops versus robbers, you know, police versus gangsters, that's a big story. That should be a big storyline, but it wasn't really, was it?
No, I'm making it sound actually worse than it actually is, but I just remember being really excited to go to the cinema because I haven't been for a little while. I just came out a little bit frustrated because all I really got was a decent performance, something to kind of push Hardy to get other decent roles, where everyone else is kind of pushed towards the edge, which is a bit of a shame.
Even though the overall story disappointed me, the performances I really enjoyed Hardy's performances. I think, you know, I was amazed, basically. I think that powered the film, as I said, and made it more than watchable. So I think it was definitely the heart of the film, these performances.
The thing I really liked about Hardy's performance, if anything, was the fact that it really does feel like he's playing two different people.
Yeah.
Like, even the way that they speak and pronounce the words and everything are so different. Their poises are different. If you look at them, you can see how Ronnie kind of stands out. He doesn't stand right, if that makes sense. He looks awkward all the time, whereas Reggie has this fantastic kind of cocksure swagger about him. And those things I really like, and I could really pull it out. I mean, this is, you know, it's Tom Hardy. This is someone who, he really does seem to find something in his characters and really pull them out. I mean, from Bronson to Bane, he does.
Yeah.
You know, he seems to do something really interesting, and he has this formidable presence about him. But it just really annoys me when I'm looking at a film and seeing, is that Paul Bettany? And
it was about 20-minute cameo, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry, 20-second cameo.
20 seconds, if that. And you just get the feeling that there's stuff left on the cutting room floor, and it never really, despite when it does get a little bit brutal, when it does get a little bit darkly humorous, it never really hits home. I just remember leaving and going, oh, well, I'd rather just go home and watch Lockstock again. I know it's not a true story, but at least the character, you know, at least I'm going to have a bit more of a laugh. Or even more, watch like Hangeland's like previously written films, because I didn't think this was particularly well written. Yeah. You know, this is a guy that, you know, wrote L.A. Confidential and Mystic River. So,
well, I was going to ask about this because obviously, yeah, he's written some Oscar-winning films, and he's been involved in some really big blockbusters. And this is only his fifth film he's directed, and the one I mainly remember him for was Payback, which was the late 90s. Take on Point Blank, with John Borman's 1967 film about a revenge-seeking gangster like hitman, and it was very pulpy. And Helgeland even did a director's cut of that in about 7 years later to make it even more edgy. So I remember that film, and I remember liking that film a lot when I first saw it.
It's a good little flick.
It is. But what my question really is he, does he bring that same kind of energy, and is it that case of all of his previous films, even the ones he's written, are very, very much American, and they're based around American, you know, life and crime. Is it that he doesn't really know how to do that from an English perspective?
I don't know. I mean, he's been in and around England before with a couple of recent films, and I'm sure they were written and they kind of flowed a lot better. You know, he did do A Knight's Tale, which is, you know, mostly American, but obviously set in ye old England times. And he's done things like Green Zone, which I actually think was really good. Obviously, you know, he wrote Robin Hood, which, you know, has its people who hate it, but I don't mind. And I thought, you know, it was relatively good. I think he's done some interesting stuff, but I think the energy only really comes from Hardy. Everything's really put into what Hardy does. Apart from that, you're really just going along the rails and just seeing facts kind of be really jumbled up, and that's really all I kind of found from it.
Yeah, that was the thing that kind of disappointed me, because obviously the Quaid's the Britain's most iconic gangsters, so I was expecting kind of a little bit of a history lesson, but it didn't really happen. It was just kind of a bit of flimsy narration over important things. They meet up with the mafia from America, like Maya Lansky's associates, and they're only given like brief scenes.
Yeah.
And you're kind of left thinking, well, what's going on here? Then that could be expanded into a bit more.
I fully agree. I mean, you're always expecting maybe one more scene or one maybe resolution, and you know, we shouldn't really always be looking for resolution, I guess, but it just, everything seems to be so incomplete, even when it, how it ends feels incomplete.
So would we recommend then that we go and watch The Craze then, the 1990 film, instead, potentially?
I would turn around and say that I know that there's going to be a whole bunch of people that when this film comes out on DVD, and even though people don't buy DVD anymore or anything else like that, you're going to see a whole bunch of, you're going to see it do quite well in the DVD charts. Yeah. And it will be bought by people who are buying the likes of Rise of the Foot Soldier and all these other Cockney Hard Men films, because there's still a market for them. And I say, have at it. It's worth it for the performance, but I can't see me ever watching it again. In fact, I will kind of try and look into picking up the 90s film and having a gander at that. So
I haven't seen the 90s film, but I think I'd give Legend another watch. I did enjoy it.
That's one maybe to check out then, but do it cautiously, shall we say. Yeah. So Legend's out right now on general release, and it will be out obviously for a few weeks, I should imagine. Right, we're going to switch then. We're just going to switch gears before we get to the next film and talk through the box office. And as I said before, today we're going to do it slightly differently and discuss in parallel the UK box office and the US box office, because every week we try and do the box office and keep up to date with what's doing well in Britain, because we're obviously a British-based podcast. But it just seems a little bit like we're missing a trick not to cover the US, because the US obviously gets films before we do quite often, or sometimes at least anyway. And it'll be interesting to see the trends of what's doing well over there as to what's doing well over here. So this is something we're going to try and do the comparison. Okay, so we're going to kick off then with the UK box office. We'll go UK first and then US. So at number 10 this week, this is going by the box office figures for the weekend of the 4th to the 6th, because unfortunately they don't release them until after we record the most recent weekend. But in the US it will be most recent weekend. So at number 10 for Britain is Hitman, Agent 47, which has made a total of nearly 2 million over a two-week period. It has dropped from, like, I think it was something like three. in 1 week, it has dropped to 10. as I did predict last week.
It's awful.
It is. It's awful, a load, Hitman. It's a load of pants. So yes. That doesn't surprise me in the least. At number 10, conversely, in America, is Un Gallo con Muchos Huevos. Now, I'm guessing I've said that properly. It's Mexican. Mexican, I researched this because I suspect we won't see this in Britain. It's a Mexican animated film about a chicken, I think.
yeah.
So it might be a chicken run for Mexico. I don't know.
That's what I've been told it has been called.
Oh, really?
I saw a little bit. I saw a brief article basically kind of championing it, because it's completely Mexican. It's really only for Mexican speaking audiences, and it came out on like I think it was like only 360 something screens.
Yeah,
it made more than enough money to show that the audience is interested in it. It was quite bizarre.
It's made $6 million, which isn't bad considering it's been on a fraction of screens, and it went in at number 9 last week. It's done quite well to get where it is, really. So fair play to it. But as I say, it's very unlikely I think we'll see it over here. At number 9 in England is The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which is in its fourth week and has made nearly £6 million, which is great. I think The Man from U.N.C.L.E. is a load of fun, so I'm very happy that's done all right.
I really liked it, but I don't think it's made a lot of money worldwide, has it?
Don't know. I think it's number 11 in the US right now. It's made $43 million in America, which is not much at all.
No.
That's the total gross over 5 weeks. I mean, that's piss water money. That's nothing. That's actually really, really low, which is a bit strange, really, because maybe it's just a little bit too anachronistic for people these days. It's not superheroes or mindless action. It's somewhere in between. So it's got a bit more class.
I think it's a shame, because I think it's really fun film. It's like there's not many not many films like it. It's quite, you can have a really good time with it, but
yeah,
it's a shame that not many people saw it. Really,
that is a shame, because it means we'll probably won't get a sequel now, and it was teed up nicely for a fun sequel. So that's a shame potentially if that's the case. No. And number 9 in America anyway is a new entry called 90 Minutes in Heaven, which has made $2 million in its first week. And I researched this, and it's about Hayden Christensen getting into a car accident, going to heaven, remembering heaven, and then coming back to life.
Are you kidding me?
No.
I heard about that, and I think it sounds a good premise, but not with Hayden Christensen.
No.
And if they had a decent actor as the lead role, then maybe I'd be interested. But
well, hang on, pause there for a minute, Kane, because it does also have Kate Bosworth.
Okay.
So it's really punching heights here for the acting talents. But yeah, it sounds bonkers, really. I mean, quite a fun premise, but whether we'll get that over here, I don't know. I haven't heard about a release over here for that, so we'll see. Didn't open to many screens, so that I dare say will drop very quickly. In the UK, at number 8, anyway, is American Ultra, which went straight in a new entry, which was, and he's only made £347,000, and that's just got very mixed reviews, and it's basically it made like 14 million in the US, so it's a bomb, really. It's a box office bomb.
I thought it was okay. I think it tried to be funny, but I think that maybe Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart weren't the right cast, weren't the right leads. I think they couldn't like milk the funniness out of the scenes, because they do find themselves in some quite daft situations, but they could never really milk out the comedy.
I've heard things like this, akin to this. It seems like one of those premises where nobody quite knows what to make of it, certainly for marketing purposes and things like that. It seems a bit of a mad confusion, really. So, a number 8 in America, anyway, is The Transporter Refueled. In its second week, it's made 13 million, which isn't particularly very much, but then that's just a silly, mindless action bit of nonsense without a big star either. So it's, you know, it's not really going to grab people particularly, and the word is it's not very good. So in the UK, it's the number 7, speaking of The Transporter Refueled, it's made 352,000. Again, that's on its first week of release. So again, similar story, really. Hasn't done that much business. Whether it will be enough to get another sequel, who knows? Who cares?
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
At number 7 in America is No Escape, which is the on its third week of release, it's made 24 million, which is the one with Owen Wilson and Pierce Brosnan on a roof escaping an embassy or something like that, I think. I don't know if you've seen this one or come across this one, either of you.
No, I haven't seen it. I've heard about it.
Yeah.
It sounds not great, but I could be very wrong.
I don't know. I might give it a go, but it doesn't particularly interest me.
I've heard it's not too bad, but it's not one of them that's just got one of those premises where you go, okay, maybe.
I think the premise, because you've been hearing, where was it? Was it Turkey? Where is it where those people on holiday got attacked?
Oh, yeah, I can't remember the country, but yeah.
But I think like it's got a timely premise, but I think, I don't know, Owen Wilson in an action movie. I don't know.
Haven't his days kind of gone from action movies from since what was that one? No One Left Behind.
Behind Enemy Lines.
That's the one.
Yeah. Exactly. He's a really odd choice, isn't he, for that role? Yeah. When I saw that, I was like, Owen Wilson, really? You know. Anyway, at number 6 in England is Pixels, which at 4 weeks has made 7.5 million. Which my co-host Dan Taylor will be horrified to learn, because he thinks it's terrible. I haven't seen it. I can't bring myself to see it. Have either of you seen Pixels?
No, I haven't.
No, it looks rubbish.
After that 10-minute rant that first came out, I was just like, I really have to wait for it to come out on Netflix so I can watch it. There's no way I'm paying money to see that.
Same. And number 6 in America is a big hit. Straight Out of Compton, which we will see on the British list very soon. It's made $155 million in America alone, so that's a big, big hit. I think it's not a surprise remotely at all that that's done well, and by the sound of it, it's very good. So I'm looking forward to seeing that at some point.
Yeah, you definitely should.
Is it good? Really, did you like it?
I did. Well, to be honest, I'm a bit biased because I'm a hip hop fan and I've always loved
cool.
it. But yeah, I loved it. I had a great time with it. I've seen it twice already. And
oh, wicked!
I've only seen it the once at the moment, but I really loved it. I watched it around the same time I watched Inside Out as well, so I was generally quite happy. I found it really joyous. Yeah. I'm a bit of a hip hop fan myself, and it was just a massive music history lesson. Oh, yeah. It was a really, really good one at that. But I found once again the performances on there were kind of uncanny. A little bit scary on how close to the real people those young guys were. It was really good.
And Eazy-E in particular, he stole the show. He was definitely the best.
Oh yeah, the charisma on that guy was fantastic. Yeah.
Surprisingly funny as well.
Yeah,
I keep hearing this definitely from a lot of people. So no, I am excited for that one. At number five in Britain is Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which on its first week of release made 431,000. A little bit of an indie film, which has been getting fairly decent reviews actually, but it's not one I think that is going to go and be a massively memorable one on the box office. Unlike at number five in America, which is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, which has made 188 million domestically. That's obviously been quite a big hit now. I think it's up to about 500-600 million worldwide. So that's guaranteed number six before Tom Cruise gets too old to throw himself off buildings and hang onto planes and presumably next time get on a rocket and eject into space, which is surely the next thing he's going to do. At number four in the US is A Walk in the Woods, which is the Bill Bryson biography with Nick Nolte as Bill Bryson, because that's how he sounds. He's become one of those actors where his voice has changed as he's got older. He always had a fairly deep voice, but Nick Nolte really sounds like that now. Like Danny Glover's got a lisp as he's got older.
Like Tom Waits.
Yeah, he sounds like Tom Waits now. And it's weird. Suddenly I watched a film with him and I went, when did that happen? Anyway, so Robert Redford's in that one as well. I think we get that in a few weeks. So that's made 19 million. One for the older set, really, but might be worth a watch. At number three in the UK is No Escape, which in its first week made 637,000. So that's not too bad, really. Probably quite a light week for half-decent films. And number three in America was War Room, which has made nearly 40 million. That one got a bit of controversy because it was people were saying it was awful, that it was a really, really bad film. Have you heard about this?
Is it the religious one?
I think so.
Yeah, I have heard about it, but
it's about an aunt. It's about an aunt and a family, but I don't know much more about that. But I heard it was really bad, or that it was a bit controversial in some respects.
Oh God!
But I don't know. That's one to that's in its third week at the US anyway. I don't know when we get that one, but we'll hear more about that soon. And number two in the UK is Inside Out, which is going nowhere fast. That's made 36 million, and it's wonderful. So that's great that it's done well. At number two in America is The Visit, the new M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong film, which has made 25 million in the first week.
I just watched that today, actually.
We're going to review that next week, probably. But what in broad strokes, what did you think, Kane? Did you like it?
Yeah, I did, actually. It wasn't a lot of horror, but it was definitely creepy. It was quite funny as well, actually. I had a good time with it. It was it wasn't bad like a lot of M. Night's other recent films have been.
I was going to say it can't be much worse than The Last Airbender or After Earth, which was shocking.
It was decent. It won't change your life watching it, but you could have a good time, definitely.
Cool. That's out now, but we'll be getting to that probably next week, as I say. At number one in the UK, however, is Straight Outta Compton, which is no surprise. That's made 5 million in 2 weeks, so that's doing quite well. I expect that'll be in the charts for a few weeks still, because it's been quite a sensation. And at number one in America, just proving to show that people will watch any old shit, is a film called The Perfect Guy, which has made 26 million in its first week. And I will just briefly describe the synopsis for you. After a painful breakup, successful lobbyist Leah Vaughan, Sana Lathan, who I do like, she's a good actress, jumps into a passionate relationship with a charming stranger, Michael Ealy. When her ex-boyfriend, Maurice Chestnut, resurfaces in her life, she has to figure out who she should trust and who she should fear. It's and the poster has, she's got half a knockers out. Immediately goes to IMDb. it's really got quite a sort of lascivious poster. It does sound a little bit like cheesy sort of Fatal Attraction-y kind of, I don't know, kind of thing, or Basic Instinct maybe, I don't know, but I haven't heard us getting a release for that.
I'm looking at people who are in it, and I know for just for a fact that what will happen is The Perfect Guy will come out on DVD here.
Yeah, definitely.
It will bypass any sort of cinematic thing here. They really will believe no one will want to watch The Perfect Guy, even though there's clearly going to be a market for this sort of thing.
Well, true, there is. And to be fair, the actors in it are pretty good. I quite like them, actually. But yeah, we will. The title's misleading, though, because that, to me, that sounds like a romantic comedy, a shitty romantic comedy with, like,
yeah, it does.
Sandra Bullock before she started doing decent things like Gravity. So it's weird. It's just through me.
What are you on about? Sandra Bullock was always doing decent things. Do you not remember Demolition Man?
Well, okay, and Speed. But then she did like then she was doing like The Proposal.
Hey, these Hollywood stars and their love of boats and extensions.
Didn't she win a Razzie for something recently as well?
I think that was The Blind Side. I think she ran it for.
The same year. I think she won an Oscar for something as well. I think it was the same year.
It probably would be The Blind Side too.
So yeah, that was the box office anyway from the US and the UK. We'll be back having a look at certainly the UK one next week and see how that falls. Moving on, we're going on to our second and final film of the podcast, which is Maze Runner: The Scorch Trials, which is Wes Ball's sequel to the first James Dashner adaptation, simply called The Maze Runner, which involves a dystopian future, young adults, and lots of running. Here's a clip from that film.
Thomas, thank you for seeing me. I'm sorry for the inconvenience. I was just hoping we might get a moment to chat in private, away from the others. Well, I won't take up too much of your time. I really only have one question. What do you remember about Wicked? You're not in trouble. We're just having a conversation. I'm just trying to understand.
Understand what?
Whose side are you on?
The Scorch Trials. Interestingly enough, when it comes up as the title doesn't say Maze Runner: The Scorch Trials. It just says The Scorch Trials, which, to be fair, is fair enough, because there's no maze in this at all. there is no maze. The maze is done. The maze is gone. And this features the characters of Thomas and his ragtag group as they enter the Scorch. Kane, you've seen this, haven't you? What did you think?
I thought it was just okay, really. I mean, it's just like the first one, really. Pretty much the exact same quality. I think the action scenes were really good. They were tense and they were well done. But I think it lacked personality as a whole. You know, no characters had any charisma or anything. So when there was no action going on, it was kind of just the quiet character-driven moments that didn't really, kind of lost a bit of interest. But when shit was going down, that was when he was at his best, definitely.
I could not agree more, quite frankly. I think you're spot on, absolutely spot on. I just watched The Maze Runner about a week ago, and I was surprised at how much I liked that, actually. I thought, you know, I've watched Insurgent, Divergent, or as Mark Kermode calls them, Suggestive Digestive, which I love. it's just, and they're just just rubbish, both of them. Yes. And I was thinking, oh, here we go, here's another one. But no, The Maze Runner was good because it had that air of mystery about it, and you were genuinely not sure where it was going to an extent, and it had very much like the Lord of the Flies kind of vibe, or with a little bit of Stand By Me in there, and I enjoyed that. I thought it was good, even though it did have a horrible 5-10 minutes. Let's explain the whole thing to you at the very end with Patricia Clarkson. But then this one immediately just loses any sense of interest in like world building or character building at all. By putting them just in a normal dystopian world, which in a nutshell is there was a solar flare which created a virus which has turned most of the population into not zombies but actually zombies, lots of things that walk around going and hiding in old buildings that have collapsed in San Francisco, which has now become a desert. And yeah, stay with me on this. And then you've got this group of evil scientists trying to find a cure by basically just doing evil things, which I won't go into because that's a bit spoilery. And then you've got other people out there, like ragtag groups, who are trying to exploit things for their own reasons. And then you've got, oh, of course, there's a resistance who are trying to... It's nothing new. It's exactly the same kind of stuff you see in all of these dystopian kind of stories and films, which is some really bland young people who are on a quest, and the lead character is conflicted and has a troubled past, and we're supposed to really give a shit about, and he's incredibly boring.
Yeah.
Dylan O'Brien, he looks the part. Yeah, he does good running, and there's loads of running in this film.
Did you say Bart will run for his money?
Yeah, he would. Because all he does is run, ask people questions, and look very pensive and, you know, troubled. And that's all he does for the whole film. And then what was interesting was the rest, all the characters, there's some good... some decent character actors in this. You know, Thomas Brodie Sangster is one of the kids. He's a decent character actor who gets naff all to do. You've got Patricia Clarkson, who's only in like 10 minutes of it, and she's great in everything, really, but she gets naff all to do. You've got Aidan Gillen, who's basically playing Littlefinger from Game of Thrones, coming on with that Irish, you know, trust me, I'm not evil, trust me, I'm your friend, it's fine. And you know, I said to my girlfriend, I said if they really wanted us to believe that this guy is actually all right, don't cast Littlefinger.
No.
You know, it's like, why would you cast Aidan Gillen? He's obviously going to be a bad guy.
Yeah, he was obviously shady, wasn't he?
Yeah, straight away you're like, yeah, don't trust him. No. So you know, but then you've got all these characters who aren't particularly very interesting, doing a lot of running. And like you said, Kane, the action sequences are good. It looks very good. You know, production-wise, it's very nicely done. Wes Ball, the director, has a history of VFX, and you can see that.
Yeah, the CGI was amazing, I think.
Yeah.
It looks really convincing, you know, the ruins, the ruined city, the post-apocalyptic city. I thought the CGI impressed me, definitely.
Absolutely. And you know, the vista of like San Francisco with the Golden Gate Bridge half buried under like sand.
Why is everything in San Francisco recently?
Yeah.
Inside Out was there, Terminator, Genesis was there, or Genesis, however you say it. There's been a few things in San Francisco recently, if you notice.
Maybe they're just sick of Los Angeles getting trashed. No, it was the CGI looks good, and there's some good action sequences, you know. And when it's motoring in that sense, it's actually quite good.
I thought the zombies were quite good as well.
Yeah, they were.
They were quite scary.
Were scary, and this is a 12A, and it's very just a 12A. I mean, you know, there was some really quite the moments where you jump, you know, some quite horrible bits. So no, that's quite evocative. So visually, very good. The odd decent action sequence, although by the end it gets lost into a bit of a muddle of plotting, and then the final action sequence is just a little bit rubbish.
The second half bored me a little bit. I think
there wasn't
really enough going on.
No.
And as we said before, like the quieter moments, it was just a bit boring. It just seemed to kind of drag on. I think it was over 2 hours, wasn't it?
It was getting on for that, yeah, if not over, definitely. It was too long.
Felt like it dragged. I think they just needed just some dynamic characters, really. Some people you really cared about.
Well, you know, if you think about Hunger Games, you know, Katniss Everdeen, you know, I mean, Jennifer Lawrence is a great actress anyway, but Katniss is a really interesting you know, forward character. There's some interesting, decent characters around her, and without spoiling anything, they've basically nicked the Peter story in some respects with this for the lead character, the lead actress, which is Kaya Scolodaro from Skins, who might as well not have turned up because she gets about five lines through the whole thing, and there's a big thing at the end that hinges on her, and it is so, you just go, oh, what? You know, and then you don't care at all. It's supposed to be this big revelation moment, this big powerful sort of, oh my God, jaw-dropping, and you just go, oh, okay, really? Yeah. Right, fine. It's given us something to do after 90 minutes. And it was just, by the end, like you, I was bored, yeah. And I was thinking, let's call it a day now. I've got the gist, I know where it's going, I know how it's going to end, I know what you're setting up, let's just get on with it, let me go home, let me put my feet up, and I'll see you in a year.
Although to be honest, I didn't mind the big shootout at the end. I didn't mind that bit. I had a bit of, it picked things up a little bit because as we said, the last hour was slow, so that kind of got my attention back up. But
in fairness, Natalie Emmanuel did turn up at that point, so that did get my attention.
Yeah, but she didn't do too much, though, did she? Really?
No, but she's there to look at, which is nice. But no, I know what you mean. It was, yeah, there was a lot of people in this who don't get much to do.
Nah.
It was weird because there's quite a lot of characters, but nobody seems to get much to do.
Well, there was loads of new characters introduced in this one, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I didn't mind Gus from Breaking Bad. He was George.
Yeah, he was quite good. He was. Yeah. Because he actually had a bit of oomph about him, didn't he? And a bit of spark. But he was, it'll be interesting. As I sit in my living room, I've got the books on my bookcase and I haven't read them yet. I'm interested. I intend to read them and read The Death Cure, which is the one that's coming next year before the film, to see how the books deal with a lot of this, because
I've heard the Scorch Trials, it's quite different from the Scorch Trials book. I've heard they made a few big changes.
Interesting. That'll be interesting to see. But yeah, I'm with you. I think it was a middling experience. I was disappointed, quite honestly, because I was pleasantly surprised by The Maze Runner. I really had a good time with that. And with this, I was like, it's just watered down. I'm not that bothered. But I'll be back next year. Will you be back next year, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. It wasn't. Yeah. I didn't leave disappointed, but I left like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
There was enough there for me to see another one. But I'm not dying to see it.
Right. No, I know what you mean. Les, do you think you'll bother now? Now we've given it a glowing...
Well, I stopped at the first one because I just found it quite... I found it quite generic. All these young adult things sort of come out. And I've got a friend of mine and we kind of debate this stuff all the time. And one of the talks that came up was there was an article a few months ago basically... trying to not only bigging up young adult books, but just saying that I read nothing but young adult books. And there was someone else saying that, you know, we need to, as adults, we need to kind of stop reading this stuff because, you know, what are we gaining from it or anything else like that? Mm. You know, I feel that if the books are there and people are interested in the books, that's fine. But unfortunately, at this moment in time, they're kind of making kind of mediocre films. I find it really difficult because obviously the girlfriend loves these things. the Hunger Games, Insurgent. There's just a few of them that she's watched. I mean, and they also kind of branch out as well. So it's not just that kind, not just the sci-fi stuff. So you also got Fault in Our Stars and all this. And I'm not really getting anything out of them at all. I think. They're not made for me. That I don't see anything in them that I really kind of cling to. But you know, they seem to make money. I'm really surprised that The Maze Runner was as successful as it did to make money. I thought it was really gonna kind of peter out there because it just didn't really have too much going for it in my view. But I'm shocked that there's a sequel. But I just can't see myself, you know, making the trek to watch it. I'm not sure if I told you you guys this before, but I've had a driving license for ages, but I don't drive. So when I go to the cinema, I walk. I don't trust buses. And here's the thing: it's now getting to a point where if I'm going to go to the cinema, I'm walking. It's a good half an hour. So you kind of want to make sure that what you're going to watch is something that you really want to watch.
That makes sense. That does make sense. Yeah, it's one for fans and completists, I think. One's for the young adult crowd, but I think unless you're a massive Maze Runner fan or you are really into this kind of movie, I would wait till it's on Netflix or Now TV or whatever, Amazon Prime, and then if you've got a spare afternoon, give it a whirl. So Maze Runner, the Scorch Trials will be running in cinemas for a few weeks. Sorry, I shouldn't be doing those jokes. Yeah, it'll be there for a few weeks, I dare say. And before we finish, we're going to take a little look at an actor in the actor's spotlight section, which I've done director's corner on this podcast before a couple of times, but I'm now going to branch out and do actor ones, because on the blog, Black Hole Online, which is our associated blog, we do actor and actor spotlights and director's corners, written ones. But in this case, we're going to do an actor spotlight on Tom Hardy, given, obviously, legend this week, and just have a little look at his career and his trajectory, really, because he's arguably become one of the biggest stars in Hollywood now. He's proper A-list. And it's interesting to see where he's come over pretty much the last 15 years. Because he's made some interesting films that have got him to where he is. Can either of you remember, or do you know, what his first movie was, or his first breakthrough was?
No. And the worst thing is, I was looking up on his bio earlier, and I can't remember for the life of me.
I think his first big part was in a Star Trek film, wasn't it? Or big-ish part.
That was his first major role as Shinzon, the Romulan clone thing.
I'm not looking, so believe me when I say this, I think I remember. Was it Black Hawk Down?
Yes, well done. Although he was credited as Thomas Hardy, which presumably he quickly dropped so he doesn't get linked to a dead novelist. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Black Hawk Down. He had a part in that. But yeah, Kane, you're right. His first major role was Star Trek Nemesis. And it's interesting, if you, on YouTube, there is footage of him and Patrick Stewart doing a scene in rehearsal.
Yeah.
And there are moments in that rehearsal where he sounds exactly like Bane. And this is like 10 years before he was cast as Bane. But then he didn't really hit a big role then until Bronson, like about 6 years later. But he was in things like Layer Cake and Sucker Punch. I didn't even remember he was in Sucker Punch, but he was.
Doing what?
He played a character called Rodders. I really can't remember, but I've tried to erase Sucker Punch from my memory, if I'm honest, because it was such a horrendous piece of shit. And he was in Rock and Roller, so he's done a couple of Guy Ritchies. No, he's done one Guy Ritchie, Layer Cake with Matthew Vaughn, wasn't he? But then Bronson was the big one, I think, where people went, this guy's interesting. Have you guys seen Bronson?
Yeah, I've seen it recently as well. I've seen it again another time recently, yeah.
I saw Bronson recently. Not recently, but I think it was like the year it came out, actually, so it's not that recently. That was 2010, 2009, so yeah, I enjoyed it.
Because that was a performance that really made him stand out, I think. And then after that, the big one was the Inception, and pretty much everyone's seen Inception.
Yeah.
I think, realistically. But he was great in that, because he had that element of charisma. He didn't take it too seriously, and I think a lot of people kind of went, he's giving something interesting here. I mean, in terms of, like, as an actor, what do you guys think of him? Do you think he deserves the sort of big status he has now? Because he's become a really big star, and one of these people who people speculate he's doing all kinds of things.
Yeah, I think he's got a lot of presence. I think he works really well.
You did say a bit in Legend. You did say a bit in the Legend review about that.
Yeah, he is just... He's one of these actors that seems to just have... I can find myself gravitating towards all the time. It's one of the things I really like about him in Bronson is just how intense that performance is. And the weight that he puts on, and where he puts it on, it's a different kind of muscle that you see in other films. He's got this fantastic ability to shift his body for what the, you know, for what the performance entails. I mean, I think one film that I wasn't the biggest fan of, but I think he's quite good, he's not too bad in it, is Lawless. And he's mumbling and kind of all over the place, and he's got this kind of weird kind of stumbling walk and everything else like that, but he's generally quite engaging all the way, no matter what performance he seems to be in. He does kind of get the best out of the roles, no matter how big or small. I mean, this is a guy that, you know, Rock and Roller isn't the best Guy Ritchie film in the world, but, you know, he kind of gives it a little bit of oomph in there, and makes it kind of fun to watch, because Lord knows it's not going to be Gerard Butler. He's got this really good thing. For me, I know lots of people moan about the voice of Bane, but I found that so creepy. And one of the reasons why I really enjoyed his performance as Bane is he was clearly reaching for something a little bit different. The idea that the person that, you know, your enemy, the villain of the piece, is cultured. We always like to make sure that the villains that we watch are, we're better than them in some way. You know, we haven't got that civility. But that's one of the reasons why, you know, Anthony Hopkins has got away with it so well with Lecter and everything else like that. When you have a character that has that civility about them and has that sort of nobility as well, because it's a very clipped voice as well, it's, you know, very terrifying. The man across, you know, the maniac across the street, you'll see coming, but the guy who doesn't have that, who can sway a conversation, that's the more interesting thing. And that's one of the reasons why I think that even though the Dark Knight Rises really does boil down to a ticking time bomb again and that kind of trope, the idea of how it gets infiltrated and Bane's idea of using hope and ability to break down people, that's kind of a scary thing, because it's that thing that kind of keeps us human, that little thing about us. And Hardy really puts that forward.
Yeah, he does.
Well, I think especially with Bane, I think, you know, coming after the Joker and Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight, I think he had a hard act to follow, but a villain. But I think he rose to the occasion, because Bane was a great villain, wasn't he? He was a mental match for Batman and a physical match as well. So it was a great role. It was a great,
definitely.
I think that's what I like about the guy, is that he's got that element of intelligence in the way he acts, and that charisma. But he's also got that physicality. I mean, you saw that in Mad Max, and I think, you know, the commitment he put into helping George Miller make that such a visceral, powerful sort of ride was the fact that he can do that stuff, as well as then doing something like Locke, where he's in a car for 90 minutes having a breakdown, you know. And that's where I think he can flip, and that's why I think he's got range and depth, and he can do different things while still having that element of, he's one of those actors in that he has his own sort of style almost. He's got his own sort of swagger to him. And I think that's the sign, I think, of a genuine star, and a genuine movie star, is that they've got their own indefinable, you know, difference.
He's got pump.
Yeah, he's a guy who's got range, and he's an interesting actor, and I think it'll be interesting to see him next up in The Revenant, which is the new Alejandro González Iñárritu. I can never say his, you know what I mean? The one next year with Leo DiCaprio. Yeah, which again has been a real intense filming experience by the sound of it. So that will be interesting to see, and, you know, if he's going to be one of those. If he keeps making films that people remember and stay in the public consciousness, you know, which I suspect he will.
Yeah, I think he will.
Cool. Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. It's been good. Thanks, guys, for coming on and
thanks for having me.
Contributing. It's been a pleasure. Before we go, where can we find you both? Kane, you're on Twitter and Facebook, aren't you? You've got your own blog, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got my own blog. It's doing okay, I think. I'm not sure what the standards are.
No, it looks good to me.
Thanks. Yeah, on Twitter you can find me at The Watcher Blog. It's at The Watcher and then it's _ blog.
Cool.
And then there should be links to my blog on there, because I think it's got a bit of a daft name for the actual blog.
It's a good name, and it's a good blog, so I recommend anyone give that a read. Kane put some good stuff up on there, so yeah, give it a try, guys, is my recommendation. No, it's a pleasure. Les, how about you?
Yeah, you can find me at afrofilmviewer.com. I should have some new reviews up shortly. I'm also writing for the London Economic, and awesome. If I am able to get press accreditation for the London Film Festival, you might see more writings of myself there, and also on Twitter at AfroFilmViewer. Just, you know, tweet and say hi.
Definitely, that's exciting about London Film Festival. That's really cool.
Hey. Well, the deadline's tomorrow at time of recording, so we'll see what happens if I can get the. if I can get past everything, I think I'm making a bit of a hash of it, but if I can get past everything, we'll be all right, and I'll be there, and I'll see if I can chat to old friends and see if I haven't even looked at the program yet, because I need to see if I can get in. So
yeah, fingers crossed. Then that's awesome. That's brilliant. Les has also written for Black Hole Online, which is our blog. Which, as I keep saying, will soon be getting its own domain name and its own website properly. We've got a website, but it needs a bit of work to it. So yeah, we know that's on the horizon, and obviously, you know, we get some really good writers on there and contributing some good stuff. So give it a look, blackholeonline.wordpress.com right now. And the podcast itself, Black Hole Cinema, will soon be moving to new hosts. We're in the middle of negotiating to move to Acast, which have been very, very successful for our fellow podcasters like Foul Critics, who are increasingly great and increasingly big. So we're following their lead, and we're going over to that, and the transition will be happening in the next few months. So we'll be keeping an eye. It won't, in broad strokes, this whole thing won't change. You'll still download it in the same way and everything like that. But we just won't be linked to Podomatic ultimately in the end. But yeah, keep an eye out for that, and keep an eye on Acast, because they're a very good service. So just leaves me to thank Kane and Les. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
And we will be back next week when Dan Taylor will be hosting with some brand new guests. See you later, guys.
And like that, he's gone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.